Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Well, are you ready for a little bit of mayhem? Are you ready to explore deals, danger, and destiny? Well, that's what we're going to be discussing with my guest this evening, who is John LaCasse. And not only has he had a very interesting life, but boy, he has sure met some weird characters. And you know what? That makes for good conversation, doesn't it? John LaCasse, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Delighted to be here.
Well, you know what? You've got such a unique background that when I was reading your book, I said, all right, you are a person that has worn a number of different hats, so to speak. You have been, what do I want to say, a rebel sometimes with a cause. You are a person that is not afraid to take a risk into the unknown. What side of the family did you get all that from?
Well, I got it from both sides, really. It turns out there was quite a difference between my father and my mother, and I was an only child. So I kind of grew up as a prince with a lot of support. And my dad was a mountain man, spent all of his time in the mountains, and he took me with him. And my mother was into the fine arts. And so when I wasn't with my dad in the mountains, I would be with my mother at the marriage of Figaro. As it turned out, that turned out to be a pretty good combination for me.
Uh-huh.
And it gave me a great deal of confidence, I think, that I didn't really know I was getting, but I did. And I became kind of fearless. I'm not sure that's a good idea, but that's what happened to me. And I kind of walked into that, unfortunately, a few times. But I'm still alive. Still
yes, here. You are. Yes, you are. And that's something that you relate in the book. Now, I want people to know that you are a board advisor at Constructus Roadway Energy. You also do a podcast, which is called Tension. You've written other books, and you also have membership in the American Association of University Professors, academic honorariums at Kappa Delta Phi and Golden Key. You are in Who's Who. You have done something that I think is very, very significant in as much as you did not complete college, and I say that very carefully, until you were a very mature man. You were thrown out of schools. You were thrown out of colleges. You were really someone that decided to walk a different road. You came in apparently with this, what do I want to say, this operative manual of wanting to explore so many different arenas that took you all over into different parts of the world, but engaged you with the rich and famous and with the average Joe and Ann on the street. Your life has had a tremendous diversity, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And I think two things are in play there. One is that I didn't go back to school until I was 59. I started school when I was 59. So I was essentially coming out of a series of successful careers. The other thing is that I was curious, like you just suggested. And I also found out that because of the confidence that I had, I treated people like contemporaries. And so the problem with that in school, why I got thrown out of many universities, was because I was coming in as a contemporary. I wasn't a 22-year-old graduate student. I was a contemporary of the mature faculty. And I had opinions, because I'd been around all over the world and done many things. And so I would sit down with the faculty, and if I didn't agree with something, I would accuse them of, you know, I would I became accusatory because they had too much confidence, and that was a mistake. I could have handled it a lot better. I could have probably paid a lot less tuition because I was thrown out of George Washington University. I was tossed out of the University of Maryland. I was tossed out of Harriet Watt, all because of my attitude, because I just felt like certain faculty members were incompetent. Uh-huh. And I would tell them that. And they would say, well, you hit the road, pal. Finally, when I was, I forget what university it was, but one of the recruiters said, John, do you understand who has the power here? You can understand that.
Uh-huh.
And, because they realized that that's what I was. But the other side of that is that when I met the rich and famous, presidents of, you know, countries and captains of industry and people like that, Hollywood personalities, I found them to be really normal, not what they might have appeared to be in their public persona. They became really real people, and they were full of flaws. And I thought that was lovely. And we became friends on that basis.
Uh-huh.
So I had this wonderful experience of knowing really important people in the public space that were flawed, therefore normal. And then I had this other experience of being thrown out of school after school because I had an attitude. And I don't know where it, you know, finally ended up, but that's really what happened to me.
Uh-huh. Well, anybody who can learn from their dad, you call him a mountain man, and he definitely was that. You could skin a deer, shoot a bear, come home to sit through the marriage of Figaro, go back and spend all night trying to stay warm inside the carcass of an elk. And you, and I'm quoting from your book, I sure as hell could take this guy down with the need to make him a trophy hanging upside down in my garage. Now, when I read that, I said, okay, this is a person that you are an individual that has seen the good, the bad, and the ugly in human character, in business, and you did some things that were not legal at times, but you learned. You just said, okay, this isn't the right place to be. I'm moving on. There's so much that you were able to assimilate. And there had to have been a reason why you wanted to go back to college. What was that, John?
Well, I'm going to give my dad credit for that, really. Well, there's two people, really. My wife, Christine, one day when I was on a pretty fast track when I was in business, you know, I had three airplanes and fast cars and a bunch of stuff because I was rolling pretty good. We were doing about $200 million in volume on counter trade when I was, you know, at my peak. And I was abusing myself quite a bit. And one day, Christine said to me, she said, if you don't stop this, you're going to die. You're just going to die. And it struck me. So I walked away from everything. I just walked away. I went back to school. That's the decision to go back to school. And my father, well before that, had always encouraged me to, he used to call it get a sheepskin. He said, John, you have to get a sheepskin because that's how he thought. And somehow he wanted me to be a success. Interestingly enough, after I got my PhD, I copied a diploma and I rolled it up in a steel tube. I drove to Missoula, Montana, where he was buried, and I drove it into his grave. And I said, Dad, it's done. I did it.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't doing it in malice. I was doing it as a tribute to him. Here's the degree that you've always wanted, and here it is, Dad.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I did.
And when you did that, because people, when they would read your story in your book, Deals, Danger, Destiny, they might be mentally salivating, thinking, oh, this guy, look at what he did. He was in the yacht business. He was with the rich and famous. And yet you went through so many, what do I want to say, almost like you were defacing those accomplishments that you had achieved because you were missing something within yourself. And you reached that point where, yes, you had all of this money, and yes, you were very successful. You were able to do everything, but you had this hole in yourself. I'll just use that description. And it was pretty difficult for you to really define it, wasn't it?
Well, I didn't even recognize it. I mean, I was very unhappy toward the end, extremely unhappy. I couldn't get any, I just couldn't get satisfaction around my life. And so I began to look for other things, and I began to sabotage my own life in business. I remember one time I had a guy, I was holding a $900,000 deposit check on a yacht. And he's a well-known industrialist, calls me at home at about 9:30. And this is going to be about $15 million deal. And I jump on him for calling me after 9 o'clock at home. Now, no salesman in his right mind holding a $900,000 check will do that.
Uh-huh.
But that's what I was doing. I was starting to sabotage myself because I didn't like me. I didn't like anybody. I just wanted out. And so it was going to school that kind of saved me, really. Well, a lot of people tried to save me because, you know, they were watching me die.
Uh-huh.
Really.
Uh-huh.
And so I got lucky. And then, of course, I buried myself in school, finally. And that turned out to be pretty good.
Yes, that was very good for you. Now, some of the observations you made as you were growing up and in the real world, you say, in every society, and again, I'm quoting from your book, where top-down power prevails, rules of conduct become dogma. And that's very true. And inside these constraints, people find ways to beat the system. And that is true. That goes on in just about every culture that we are aware of. There are some that that's not the case. But in the Western world and in so many other cultures, that is very true. And often that is the very thing that creates a prison for people. And that's what you were fighting against in many, many ways. And when you talked about Gene Hackman, who is well known as a movie star, he's incredibly talented, and the opportunity you had to get to know him and to sail with him and to learn from him many things. And then you find that you get the sad news that he lost everything. Now, this is a man that was on the top of the hill. He was financially, he had everything. He had fame. He had fortune. All of this that so many people would stand and envy, and yet all of that was taken away from him. When you relate that story, that had an impact on you, didn't it?
Oh, it sure did. He came at just the right time in my career. And after the teaching, of course, that he gave me, just because of his style and because of his courtesy as a gentleman, he's a true gentleman. When I ended up walking into a house in Beverly Hills, it used to be his house. He didn't realize it. And I asked the fellow where I was, and this is a very wealthy family. I mean, I'm sitting down drinking Johnny Walker Blue at his private bar, and there are Picassos on the wall, literally Picassos on his wall. And he had just taken the house away from Hackman.
Uh-huh.
And I felt really bad because Gene Hackman had a lot of meaning to me. But, you know, that's the way it goes. And it's a law of the jungle in its own way, you know.
Uh-huh.
It really is.
Also, you give an inside track on the black market during the Vietnam War. When I was reading that, that was something that if anybody reads it, which I did, it really is almost a sad statement about what you found out about. You chose not to be a part of it, but this was something that the government was doing. The average individual had no idea in the United States that this was going on. And this was quite an eye-opener for you, too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When President Ford was a congressman, he's the first one that brought it to the public eye. He stood in the House and opened it up. but I was right in the middle of it. What was happening really was that we were essentially working both sides of the aisle in that circumstance, where we didn't have the spine as a country to stand up against the corruption of the South Vietnamese, because they were our allies. So instead of taking a public position, we simply eliminated them like a mafia inside their own organization if they weren't doing what we wanted them to do. And my job at that point, I had some background in counterinsurgency when I was in the Army ROTC, and they found me out in the Army Defense Supply. And what they did was my job was to make booby trap boxes. If you look at the USAID logo, it's two shaking hands on a bunting of the United States shield. And what we did is we crossed the thumbs on the shield, so they were incorrect. The hands were incorrectly matched. And on those boxes, we would put merchandise that wasn't supposed to be there. We'd put banning material and stuff left over from the shop. And that was given over either to the Army or the Marine Corps, where they would then siphon it off to South Vietnamese people, soldiers, that they knew were taking our supplies. We were putting about 50 tons a day into Da Nang Harbor. They were selling our supplies back to the North. These are our allies selling our supplies to the North Vietnamese. And so we started killing the South Vietnamese to stop them from selling our supplies to the North. You know?
Unreal.
Who knew?
Yes, absolutely. Because of your business, being in the yacht business, which you had never planned on being in the yacht business, but there you are, and you are a consummate salesperson, and you did a phenomenal job. But I delighted in some of the information that you share in the book, and it was about See's Candies. Now, See's Candies have been around forever, and they are wonderful, wonderful chocolates, but you revealed something that I didn't know anything about, that Mary, the image of Mary, who supposedly started See's Candy, is totally fabricated, but it was an invention of the C-S-E-E brothers. I thought that was delightful. Share that story with the audience.
Yeah. Well, they were actually the See brothers were in the commodity business, and they made a very bad sugar buy. And they were upside down, and they had to figure out a way to do something with the commodity that they owned, and it turned out to be sugar. So the brothers, Harry was one of them, started to figure out how to make candy, and they did a really good job of it. And so they made some candy, and the people would go buy the candy. They wouldn't believe that the See brothers were making this candy. It was too good for these guys to make candy. So they came up with this idea of how to fabricate someone who knew how to make candy. And they found this picture of a woman on the back of an apple box in their warehouse. And she turned out to be Mary C. And,
And they're still making money.
Oh, yeah, they are. Well, Warren Buffett bought them. So now it's one of Buffett's companies now. But and Harry's dead, unfortunately. But he was a guy. He taught me how to drink my first $25,000 glass of wine down in the cellar.
A $25,000 glass of wine. You've got to tell us how that tasted.
Well, we were playing cribbage and talking, and Harry and I. And he said, "Do you want a glass of wine?" I said, "Sure." So he says, "Well, come on, I'll take you down to the cellar." So we went down to the wine cellar. And he's got this hanging chandelier of green, of sort of purpley grapes. And the light's kind of low. And he reaches in the wall and he brings out a bottle that's full of dust. And he brings it out and he blows it off. And it's something very important. And he decants the bottle. He throws it through. I mean, he pours it through cheesecloth. And it goes down, does all this ceremonial stuff you'd do with very expensive wine. And he pours each of us a little bit and he hands me a glass. He takes a glass and we toast each other. And he said, and he looks at it and he, in the candle, and he said, I'd say it's about $25,000 a glass, frankly, John. Well, I went down to 20, but you know, good. I mean, while he's doing this, he had two Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and they were, and I have a brand new pair of Cole Haan shoes, and the dogs were eating my shoes upstairs.
Did he reimburse you on your shoes, for heaven's sakes?
No, he didn't.
Oh, my goodness. 25, you're sipping a $25,000 wine, and, you know, oh, geez. And they're eating your shoes upstairs. Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. Yeah. Now, what I found fascinating about your book is that the 2/3 of your book is about you, your life, everything that you did. And then you switch. You switch. And there are photos in your book, by the way. I wanted to be sure that I mentioned that so the audience would know. And you've got photos of your family, and I was sorry to hear about your two sons that had died.
Thank you. Thank
but you. There are all of these different stories that you share, and they are real stories. But then the last third of your book is about Thomas Aquinas. And this is something, when I was reading it, I said, okay, I've got to ask John about this. And because of your training, you were in a Jesuit school. You were supposed to become a priest. So this part is fiction, but yet you have had your own paranormal experiences, but you have folded this in at the latter part of your book because you're going to be doing another book that will be carrying the story forward relative to this section of your book. Why did you pick Thomas Aquinas?
Well, I studied Aquinas in the Summa Theologica when I was growing up, I guess. And he's the one that developed the five proofs of God for, essentially, he's the bedrock theology for the Holy Roman Empire. And I've studied physics. I've studied a great deal of paranormal, fourth and fifth dimension stuff. I kind of like it. I've talked to a lot of people. I've interviewed a lot of people that had what they're calling a near death experience, and so. And I've had some very interesting stories from these people about where they went, where they thought they went, and so on. So I find myself in Paris, and I've been to Paris five times. I went to Paris to study, and I went to Paris to kind of think this through a little bit. And as I was there, I don't know if it's a conscious decision or not, but it does make a difference, really. It happened to me that I'm sitting at Shakespeare and Company, which is probably the most famous bookstore in the world in Paris at kilometer zero. And I'm looking down and look at the Seine River, and I'm thinking about what's going on. And an ale barge comes by, and I'm thinking about the paranormal of life or of the fifth or sixth dimension, and I manifest Thomas Aquinas, and he ends up joining me on the banks of the Seine River in Paris, and he and I engage one another and have a conversation, and it's almost like Harvey. I'm walking around talking to Thomas Aquinas like we're buddies, and I'm doing this in Paris, and people think I'm crazy. Thomas Aquinas and I went to a sidewalk cafe Plaza Saint Michel, actually. And I'm sitting across the table from this person who doesn't exist, but we're having a very in-depth conversation about dogma. And one of the waiters decided to call the police, and the captain came and stopped him because it was so intense. It was so believable that they didn't want to get involved with it. And as it turns out, Aquinas was actually hunting me because he was looking for me because I had come up with a frequency. I was able to bleed off some of the frequency of the High Holy Order, and they were looking for me. And so when he figured out that I was the real deal, Aquinas killed me in Paris. And then he brought down his buddy Lucifer, which is another story. I met these two guys, and they take me up to heaven. And that's where the next book begins.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet Hildegard of Bingen. I meet Che Guevara as well. But I was going to be a priest. I spent 17 years looking at that. I spent 17 more years getting a PhD. I spent a lot of time in the physics. I spent a lot of time in paranormal psychology. And I think that we have several dimensions that we can work in if you practice, if you set yourself up for it in the proper way. I think you can walk in more than one dimension.
Oh, that's a fact. That is a fact. But I delighted in how you expressed so much through this conversation that I think many people would be very intrigued with. But I loved how you described the fact that it was like Harvey. And for those that are not familiar with it, if you're of the younger generation, Harvey is a movie. And I'm trying to remember the star, if it was Jimmy Stewart. It was some famous actor, and he was talking to a rabbit named Harvey.
That's right. That's
you have to see the movie to understand what John is talking about, because when he said, this is like talking to Harvey, I don't remember when I saw the movie. It was a number of years ago, but it's hysterical. Because this actor, and I'll say it's Jimmy Stewart, and I could be wrong, but that movie was made in the 40s in there. It's an old movie. It's black and white, and it's hysterical because he's walking around talking to this cotton picking rabbit, and everybody thinks he's loony, and he's not because he sees the rabbit, but nobody else sees the rabbit, and this rabbit communicates with him. So. Yes, the movie Harvey is definitely worth seeing. But this also approaches a factor because Thomas is very, very blunt with you. And he's not, he is not kind at all.
No.
He really sucks it to you.
Yeah, he does.
And this is really, it's really an interesting aspect of what you have written. And I think that it catches people unaware, but you have got your book in like three segments. So when they get to segment three, they're going to find a whole different dimension. And this is something, John, in your studies of the paranormal, there is not a faith religion on this planet that does not have paranormal stories to talk about. I don't care what the culture is. It's there.
That's right.
And
that's
so right. Here with you, when you've done these studies, did this, what you have experienced since you left that very glamorous, fast-paced world and you've gone to school and you have reached a very mature time in your life, how did that change you?
I think it made me... It calmed me down quite a bit. I'm not sure that I made a direct connection, but as you mentioned earlier, and I appreciate your mentioning it, two of our sons died. For a while, I really wanted to know where they were. I was curious about that. And that may have been a trigger for some of my curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of midterm. But it introduced me, my curiosity began to spin, and it introduced me to a lot of people. And I met people that were, I guess it humanized my life. because I was living in a complete arena of almost fakery in terms of how people got to where they were, even though they were normal and wonderful people. Their lives were a constant spin of money, lots of money and lots of power and lots, a lot of this, but none of it seemed to go anywhere. I didn't meet anybody. I met a lot of wonderful people that were really great folks, but I didn't see them. They didn't take me anywhere. They're just nice. So as I began my studies and began to be curious, I began to really kind of walk a little bit further and further and further into a psychic process of my own. And I'm not giving myself any special powers. I don't have any, really. I think everybody has the capacity. Frankly,
they do. Yes, I agree with you.
To step into this arena if they just practice. And so that's what I did. And I got calmer. I became a better person, in my opinion. I slowed down. I became academically, I became faculty member of the year at the Forbes School of Business. My students liked me. I had these great stories. I was just a great life. I all of a sudden went from almost a walking plasma cutter to a good guy. And I was walking around talking to Thomas Aquinas. I mean, who wouldn't want to do that,
Well, at Western State Hospital, they might admit you if they saw this in action, but I think you could have a very good conversation with the doctors. I really think, John, that it's something that I felt is that void that was in your life, when your sons died and you actually had prophetic dreams about your sons before they died. And yes, when you have those experiences, you cannot ignore them. And they bring up questions that make you aware it's not the things in life. We all want to be comfortable and we all want to have, abundance, and all of that is good. There's nothing wrong with any of that. However, there is that other part. It's what is valued. What is it that makes you feel complete and whole as a human being? And I like to call it being in connection with the God self. That's just my terminology. And it is realizing that also this experience of life is like being in school. And you have to go through certain lessons in life, one way or the other. You can be young, you can be middle-aged, you can be elderly. It doesn't make any difference. But you're going to go through processes to awaken you to the real you. And I think that's what you've discovered. How would you feel about my statement?
I think you're spot on. It's very introspective. I think that's where the most practice has to happen, is to have to become introspective of who you are. The God self, I think, is how you're describing it. That's where you must go. You must focus there, and you must practice kindness, and you must kind of get yourself ready to be accepted into another order. And I think that's all introspection, learning who you are.
Well, John, your book deals danger, destiny, and believe me, you've got some whopper stories in here. People might say, this can't be real. And you say, oh, yes, it is. And believe me, I know that those experiences were real with you. But your book presents so many different perspectives and an inside track on so much of what you saw in the real world that affected you very deeply. Your wonderful parents, I just think you were very fortunate to be their son, and what they gave you and what you are in the process of giving to others and have been now for a number of years. And people can go to your website, because you do have a podcast, and your name, John LaCasse, and that's LACASSE.com. Capital L-A, capital C-A-S-S-E .com. John, it's been a delight having you as a guest. The book is in all of the bookstores and also on Amazon, of course. But I want to thank you for being my guest. This has been delightful.
Donna, this has been a wonderful interview. I really appreciate it.
You are more than welcome. And by the way, when you get your next book, you've got to send me a copy.
I promise, dear.
All right, John. Take care
and
happy holidays to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Donna Sebo here, and we are going to be taking a break. And don't forget, John Lacasse, L-A-C-A-S-S-E, has been my guest, and you can check him out, check out his podcast, and so much more. We're going to be back, and by the way, I am in studio if you want to give me a call at 253-582-5597. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, who's coming up on The Donna Sebo Show? By the way, the phone line is open, 253-582-5597. On Monday, we're going to be talking about small business loans made simple with Ambrose Blackwell. This is significant because so often when you're wanting to start a business, it's very difficult to get loans. So Ambro, being a small businessman himself, decided to share with people some of the tips, tricks, and also actions that you can take if you want to get the financing for your business. Then we're going to be talking with Arwinder Kaur, Living While Human. Dealing with the realities of life can be quite challenging, believe me. And then we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence with PJ Caldress. And that is about the girl from Wudang. And of course, guess what? We got the gobble, gobble, gobble day. Yes, Thanksgiving, where we're all going to be able to feast and hopefully not have to waddle, waddle, waddle after we feast, but it's going to be a celebration of time, and most people are going to be having not just Thanksgiving off, but also Friday, which is called Black Friday historically, and the show goes on regardless. Now, Thanksgiving Day, there will be a pre-recorded show that is going to be aired, so I can enjoy that day myself. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking with Sophia Dimas, Consciousness Beyond Death. Now, her material is about her personal experiences with family members after they died. And also, she shares the stories of people that have told her what they have personally experienced with visitations from, could be a friend, could be a pet, could be a member of family, like it was for her, and having those experiences with those that have passed on. And then also we're going to be talking on Black Friday with Dr. Amy Stark, and she is a children's author, and her material is just wonderful. And then we've got so much more. Built for Freedom, Bob Gardner, Yesterday Never Sleeps with Jackie Heller. And then we've got Sensory Processing Solutions with Sally Fayer Dietz, and I'm trying to put together an interview with Tobias Churton. He's been on my show before, and he has got the most interesting book. It's about the first alchemists. So he goes into a lot of history, and it has to do with herbology and so many things that we have terms for today, well, that they really didn't have very much of a term for years ago because people were exploring and utilizing chemistry in a certain way. So all of that is coming up on the Donna Sebo Show and then on Warriors for Peace. Yes. Reflections on Captivity with Porter Alexander Halliburton. And this is an interview that is a very powerful one because it is about this man, Alexander. He is telling his story about being at the Hilton, the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. He was incarcerated for 7 years, and he really gives the inside information about how the men that were captured from all different branches of the services and how they were kept at the Hanoi Hilton and other places for a long time. And it's just amazing. And then we are going to have the last interview for Warriors for Peace is going to be with Walt Larimore. And I'm telling you, this book is amazing, absolutely amazing. It is about his dad who served in World War II, and his dad also was a horse whisperer. Now, that may sound a little unique, and it really is. It took him 16 years to put all of the facts together, and he wrote it in the first person, as if his dad is telling the story. It is just, it's just amazing. And you know what? I did not know that horses were a very significant part of World War II. Yep, you'll have to listen in to find out why that is the case and how the Royal Lipizzans, those beautiful, magnificent white horses, how they played a very special role in his dad's life in World War II as well. So, all of that being said, the telephone lines are open. Oh, and don't forget my television shows. Yes, there are two links. You can go into my website to the Donna Sebo Network page and also to my website to my newsletter. If you do not get that newsletter in the mail, just know that if you do get it, then there are two links. There's a segment in my newsletter that shows the two links where you can go and see the television programs that's up on YouTube. They are up on YouTube, and they're also on my website. So we have two locations for those films, and we just did show number 7. And each of my shows have their own independent theme. And so this is what is happening, and the next one that's going to be posted up on YouTube is about alternative health therapies. And I think you'll find that my guest from Bombay, India, Danny Carroll, and then a physician here in the Bellevue area, Dr. Metzger. Both of these men provide a lot of good information, enabling us to see that we have options to work with empowering ourselves to make sure that we have good health. And I think, again, you'll find it interesting. Also, I want to mention on the 29th of this month, there was a typo in my last newsletter. On the 29th of this month, I will be doing a speaking engagement at the Psychic Spectrum, the Poodle Dog Restaurant, the Banquet Room on the 29th. I'm repeating that because there was a typo of making it the 25th. The 25th is a Saturday, and the Spectrum meets on Wednesdays. And if you go to the Psychic Spectrum website, you're going to find that they will give you information how you can listen to my presentation and also watch the demonstrations that I do. And you're going to be able to do that through Zoom. So all of that information is available on their website. So I'm going to be there on the 29th. Well, I wanted to share some information with you because there's commentaries that cross my desk, and I find that people have such wonderful perceptions, and I thought I would share Lucia Capiccioni's perceptions. She is a registered art therapist, and she's done workshops. She loves to encourage creativity with people because she said it is so important to develop this side of the self. And this is what she had to say. Turning dreams into reality is child's play if you know the secret. What's a secret? It's really simple. Enter that childlike and naturally creative place in your heart and your mind. The place where you daydream. The zone where you go when you are at your most creative. Find a quiet space and time for yourself. Take some scissors, glue, paper. Get some old magazines. You're going to collage to your heart's desire. This is a very good way to put together a vision board, and those are my words. She said, this sounds like kindergarten stuff, doesn't it? But it truly begins there, where we all began. As open, imaginative, and adventurous children, wanting to explore all the possibilities life has to offer. I think it is so easy as adults. I know because I've done it myself. What is it I've done? Compartmentalize life. You know, we are bombarded with all kinds of stuff every single day. And there's propaganda that is thrown at us that if you look a certain way or if you do things a certain way, then that's what defines you. And just like my guest, John Lacasse, he had to go through all kinds of different environments, but he was willing to explore. And when he reached the point where he realized that he needed to really find out more about himself, he flipped into an environment that empowered him. It empowered him. And he stated it made him a nicer person because he did not choose to stay where he had been for all of the wealth he had, for all of the international aspects, the dealing with the rich and the famous, and all of these various components, he explored. He had opportunities that he took advantage of because they were there in front of him. He didn't say no to life. But then he also had to look at what life was going to give him. And he had to find out what he could give to life. And it really is a fascinating journey that he went through. Well, we are all going to go through some kind of journey. And many times we wonder if someone in the universe mixed up scripts because we'll say, I don't deserve this, that, or the other in our life. And perhaps you don't. But the truth is, you're in a situation, you've got certain conditions around you, you've got challenges that are in front of you. And you can either say yes to life to learn how to work with those challenges, or you can just go, I think I'm going to check out. I think I'm going to just zone out. And that is something you have an option to do as well. So I think it's so important for us to realize that we're here. We've been given the gift of life to be able to live it with purpose and even with passion. And understanding ourselves. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges we have as adults because we have all kinds of programming that goes into our head. And male, female doesn't make any difference. It's just that programming. So when we start to explore ourselves, when we start to find out who we really are, sometimes we find out we're bigger than we could have ever imagined. And we have a lot to be grateful for, number one. But number two, we've got a lot of options to work with. I think it's really quite fascinating myself. So remember, you have the right to know yourself, to be true to yourself, and to realize you can live life to your own measure. And it's not about the money. It's not about fame. It is not about anything other than finding out who you really are so that you can give the best of who you are wherever you are. And that is special. Well, of course, seasons of the year bring us into different moons, if you will. And there's a lot of people that are very wise about the cycles of the moon and this type of thing. But we experience different colors with the moon. And, of course, I'm sure you heard about the blue moon that is recognized. Depends on where you're living so that you can see it. Here in the Pacific Northwest, so often the skies are not clear. We're not able to see it, although we saw a gorgeous, gorgeous harvest moon here. Oh, it was absolutely spectacular. Well, it really isn't blue, but this was given a title because it has been observed. And, of course, it's atmospheric conditions and temperatures that affect the colors that we see with the moon having. And there is an extra full moon that occurs, apparently, every season. And, of course, that's winter, spring, summer, and fall. There's a third full moon that might be called a blue moon. And I remember, I don't remember what month it was, but it was publicized quite a bit. And so that blue moon is often associated with Native American folklore. But people throughout history, especially gardeners, were very observant of the seasons, and their wisdoms were passed along verbally to people of upcoming generations. And the reality was that every month we have one full moon, not two. However, blue moons happen about every 30 months. Remember, we've been keeping a lot of documentation on various things now. Because of computers, we've been more aware of certain patterns. So that's about every two and a half years. And the other moons that are noted in a very particular way and have been for millions of years, it's the harvest moon and the black moon. Now, this does not have a reference to an eclipse, but the black moon refers to a month in which there is no full moon. And then there is the super moon, which I had not heard of. And it is a full moon when it is at the point in its orbit closest to the Earth. So here are all these definitions and the different expressions that we perceive with the moon. But many gardeners will talk about planting certain foods in a full moon cycle, and they say what you should do is any annual flowers and vegetables that bear crops above ground during the light or the waxing of the moon, and that's from the day the moon is new to the day until it is full, that's when you do those annual plantings. And then to plant your flowering bulbs, biennial and perennial flowers, and vegetables that bear crops below the ground during the dark or the waning of the moon from the day after it is full to the day when it is new again. And you know, farmers, they say the old-time farmers say when you plant that way, you're going to have a bigger, better, more, well, what do I want to say, more vigorous crop? So these things are not taken lightly by many people that deal with growing things in the earth, and it is just fascinating information. But people have been doing this for a very, very long period of time. Well, I don't know about you, but here we are, holiday season. Thanksgiving is next week. And how about fixing something a little different? I don't know about you, but I always like to fix cookies. And I usually try to avoid fixing cookies because I like to eat them. So there are some recipes, though, that I absolutely, absolutely love and have been very, very successful. And I've shared some of those recipes with you. One of them are the triple chocolate cookies, which are just amazing. But there's some recipes that were passed along to me. And there's one that was called Grandma's Cakes. Or they're called Grandma's Cakeys. And this is just a real simple recipe that I thought I would share with you. And I'll give you the ingredients. There's a teaspoon of baking soda, a half a cup of sour cream. Oh, I've got to mention, all ingredients must be at room temperature. You need 3/4 cup, and that's 1.5 sticks of butter. No margarine, please. Real butter. 1.5 cups of sugar. 3 eggs, again, room temperature, all ingredients. You beat those eggs until they're totally blended. 1.5 teaspoons of vanilla, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 4 cups of all-purpose flour. You might need a little bit extra, you might not. 1/2 cup of all-purpose flour, 1/4 cup of sugar. And be sure you have some extra sugar on the side. So get those ingredients all out, have them all measured, because this comes together very, very quickly. Your baking soda you're going to put into the sour cream, and it's going to get puffy. It's going to take anywhere, depending on the temperature in your kitchen, 5 to 10 minutes. Then what you're going to do with your electric mixer, that room temperature butter, that 1.5 sticks of butter, you're going to beat that butter until it's light and fluffy, and then gradually beat in the 1.5 cups of sugar and your eggs. Then you're going to blend into that mixture the sour cream that's got the baking soda in it, vanilla, and salt. All of that is thoroughly blended together. Then you stir in 4 cups of flour, 1 cup at a time. And if you find the dough is really sticky, add 1 tablespoon of flour, no more than 2 tablespoons. So 1 tablespoon at a time if the dough appears sticky. So however it works out for you, it's either 1 tablespoon extra of flour or 2, and that's it. Then you want to wrap it in plastic wrap, wax paper, whatever you choose, and you want to chill this dough for 3 hours. So you've mixed everything, it's all ready to go, and you've let it chill for 3 hours. Now it's time for baking. So what you're going to do, you're going to preheat your oven to 375 degrees. Your baking sheets, I like using parchment paper in my baking sheets, but if you don't want to do that, you just use nonstick cooking spray. Spray those sheets. And divide the dough into thirds. After you cut it into the thirds, you put 2/3 back in the fridge. You're going to mix 1 cup of flour, 1/2 cup of flour and 1/4 cup of sugar. Mix that together. Sprinkle your work surface with some of the flour mixture. Roll 1 piece of dough out to the thickness of 1/4 inch. You work quickly because you don't want it to get too warm. Cut out your rounds using 3-inch cutter. Gather the scraps, refrigerate, re-roll, and cut additional rounds. And then put 7 rounds on a prepared sheet, sprinkle the tops with sugar, repeat with the remaining dough. You bake them for about 10 minutes. Tops should not brown at all. Cool completely before serving, and they keep. You know, as long as nobody's hungry. So that it's very simple, and then you can sprinkle some colored sugar on the top, whatever you'd like to do. Very simple, very easy, and very, very tasty. And if you wanted to change the flavor, you could add almond flavor, whatever you'd like. Maybe you want to add some lemon rind and use lemon flavoring instead. Try things out. But this basic recipe is easy, and it's something that is really good. Donna Sebo here. We're saying goodbye for this evening. Have a fabulous weekend. And remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. I'll be talking with you again soon. Bye for now.
been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.